The Bill W. Lunch Group is a very sensitive group. I was given a safe chip. Excuse my voice. We're going to try to make it through. I hope you can tolerate it. I want to thank Bill and thank the committee for inviting me. It's indeed an honor for someone like myself to be invited to speak to the anniversary group. I brought some notes with me. It's going to be quite a bargain tonight. Six cassettes for $5. I don't want to say I was a difficult man to sponsor, but Bill was one of my early sponsors. And when Bill started sponsoring me, he was 6'4" and had dark, curly hair. My home group is the East Marietta group. They're meeting this evening. In fact, as I speak, they're meeting in East Cobb at Holy Family Church. And I'm here speaking to you, knowing full well that back in East Marietta, things are not going quite as well as they should. This is the type of thing I avoided doing the first couple of years of my sobriety, because when I was drinking, I did this kind of thing all the time. And I always like to say I never went to a wake or a wedding because I couldn't be the bride or the corpse. As the chip indicates, I've been around AA for a pretty long time. It's obvious from looking at me, I've been somewhere for a pretty long time. The talk you're going to hear this evening is from my most recent book, entitled, There's a Reason That Road Is Less Traveled, Stupid. Because I'm a speaker, I guess I always felt it was incumbent to show up wearing a jacket and tie. You're lucky it's warmer weather. I usually wear a vest. I make my living as a lawyer, and that seems to be a compulsory uniform. It also helped me early on. See, I always knew I was a high-bottom drunk because I had to hold in my silk tie when I threw up. I got around that by wearing a vest. Except the vest created other problems. I used to stagger into the men's room, stumble over to the latrine, open my vest, pull out my tie, and pee in my pants. Very difficult times, difficult times. I got sober at the at Rebus over in Cobb County. A law partner of mine got sober at the Betty Ford Clinic. I always resented people with material advantages. They always gripe me that he got sober at the Betty Ford Clinic in Palm Springs. I had to get sober at goddamn Rebus. And it grated on me for a while till I realized why I didn't get sober at the Betty Ford Clinic. It was because when I got sober, Betty Ford was still drinking. But I never let facts interfere with my resentments. Not having gone to treatment, there is some language you will not hear from me tonight, and I want to review it with you now. I will not be seeking my inner child. I will not relate to you. You will not identify with me. I will give you no input, and I will expect no feedback. This will not be a learning experience, nor will it be a growth period. We will neither interface nor empathize. There will be no bonding, no nurturing, no empowering. We will not establish a relationship. We will not have a meaningful dialogue. And we will certainly not spend any quality time together. We will not be supportive of one another so that we can get in touch with our feelings in order to feel good about ourselves. And if any of you feel like you need a little space, get outside. Have you got all those tapes ready? I was born in New Jersey to an Irish Catholic family. I know it's rare to find Irish Catholics in this program. But I'm one of those rare Irish Catholics. I went through the Catholic school system, into college and law school. The Jesuits taught me how to think, and I haven't felt safe since. I learned things like philosophy, metaphysics, epistemology, logic, syllogistic reasoning. You know, God is love, love is blind, Ray Charles is blind, therefore Ray Charles is God. Not only was I exposed to Catholic philosophy courses, I had the additional intellectually crippling experience of having gone to law school. I went through law school with flying colors. See, I was always smart, so I did smart stuff. I had a scholarship to law school. Just before I got out of law school, I committed matrimony. I did this in front of witnesses. Matrimony in the first degree is punishable by life. I say that because my wife is not with me tonight. She's picking up my daughter. She used to do nasty things to me. I would say my prayers in the evening, kneeling in the bathroom, bending over the bowl. Oh, God. And she'd walk by and say cute things like, "He's not down there." And near the end of my drinking, we'd be going to parties, and she'd say things. She gave up on saying, "You know, don't drink so much tonight. Don't get drunk tonight." She'd say nasty things like, "Dick, just once tonight, say, I don't know." She actually wanted me to lie to those people. But I got even with her when, if she is present, when I tell my story, I tell everyone that I never admitted to hiding my liquor, but I did keep it behind the iron. We owe the 30-year longevity of our marriage to the fact that we have never, ever had an in-depth discussion. My drinking started in earnest, I guess, when I hit around 16 or 17. Like most of us, we get introduced to alcohol of the opposite sex at around the same time. And we always wonder why we have trouble with relationships. I got married in 67. A few years later, we had our first child. I got a job and I drank. After the first child was born, my drinking continued. And dissatisfaction with my drinking increased, and I decided to take the geographical cure. We moved to Atlanta. Alcoholics don't have relationships. We take hostages. So I moved my hostages to Atlanta, and when I got here, there was a second child was born, my son Brendan. I kept drinking. Brendan had some very special needs, and I wasn't available. My drinking continued. I had some health problems. I had what they thought was prostate cancer. It turned out not to be. That was my first exposure to humility, by the way, submitting to the prostate exams. The only problem with those is I began to like them. It was at this time that I started bumping into continuing resistance to my drinking. I didn't want to go to AA because, after all, I was a professional, and I thought I'd go to other professionals, so I went back to my urologist, since by this time he knew me so well. And he suggested a psychiatrist, and I went to the psychiatrist and paid him $80 an hour for the privilege of lying to him. Well, I didn't really lie to him. I told him only as much as I thought he needed to know to help me. Apparently, I misjudged. Under continuing pressure, in January of 77, I went to Rebus. It was a clubhouse, a place that people knew how to get to. So I went there and I picked up a couple of brochures to show I had been there. Went home drunk that night, threw the brochures on the table and said, "See, the damn thing doesn't work." I knew there was something wrong with my life. I had no idea that it had anything to do with drinking, because I grew up in New Jersey among very heavy drinking non-alcoholics, and I thought it had something to do with quantity. And I drank nowhere near as much as some of those men did, and yet I seemed to have the problems. And because I drank less than they did, I could not imagine how my problems had anything to do with drinking. It was them. It was something else. It wasn't me. It wasn't the booze. It was something else. It was kind of like that Irishman at the turn of the century whose wife was having a troublesome pregnancy, and the midwife of the village said, "You better get a doctor for this." So we brought the doctor out to his thatched roof cabin with no electricity, no lights, and brought the doctor to his wife in the back room and said, "Can I do anything to help, doctor?" He says, "Yeah, Pat, get me a lantern so I can see what I'm doing." So he brought the lantern in, and no sooner did he arrive when he heard smack. Wah! He says, "Pat, it's a baby boy you have. He's a small one. He's only 4.5 pounds, but he looks healthy and he's fine." And he goes, "Oh, my God, I've got a son. I'll go to the pub. We'll celebrate." And he turns around to walk out, and the doctor says, "Pat, get back here with that lantern." So he comes back in, and no sooner does he get back in, you hear another smack and another cry. He goes, "Pat, it's two of them you have. 4, 4.5 pounds, but he looks healthy. It's another boy." He goes, "Oh, my God, two sons. We'll go to the pub. We'll celebrate all weekend." He's walking out, and the doctor says, "Pat, get back here with that lantern." He comes back in. He goes, smack, wow. He says, "Pat, it's three of them you have. You got three sons." He says, "Doctor, you sure it's not the light that's attracting them?" I didn't know where my difficulties were coming from, but they were coming. And I thought it might be the light that was attracting him, but they seemed to attract themselves to me. And it was, I didn't associate it with alcohol. I thought it was just a 4 or 5 year string of bad luck. But having gone to Rebus in January, I was in May asked to leave the house and went to the only place I knew, Rebus again. And leaving the house was not my bottom at the time. I always was so proud of how smart I was. And I saw some work I had just done and compared it with work I had done 5 years earlier. And I could see that I was losing much of the intellect of which I was proud and much of the ability to articulate ideas of which I was so damn proud. And I was losing those things. And the wife and the children didn't matter as much as those things did to me at that time. And that was my bottom. And I went back to the clubhouse at Rebus. Now, the first time I went there, they told me, you know, don't drink and go to meetings. And I knew that those people were not as smart as I was. The second time I went back, they had smarter people there. They told me, don't drink and go to meetings. And they expressed it in a way that made sense to me at this time. There's nothing like desperation to make you a little more flexible. So I got there, and in Rebus in those days, at the meeting I went to, if you didn't have a sponsor, you got one before you left, whether you wanted one or not. And I had this fella, he was, what's the word? He was inflicted on me by the group. And he insisted I take the steps, and I started with the steps. The first one says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. The program for me has been one of spiritual growth. And essentially, that's what it is, a spiritual awakening, they tell us in the 12th step. And that spiritual awakening began with the first word of that first step for me. It said, we. I had never been part of a we. I was always gloriously independent, off by my own somewhere. It didn't work in school. I was in a lot of groups in school. And I handled my inability to deal with people directly by getting elected to the leadership positions in those clubs I belonged to. So I was the president of this and the president of that, which means I didn't have to sit out there with these, so I could be up here like this and pretend to be part of the group. Yet I never really was. Everything was a hassle despite the success I had in school. I was always smart. Later on in trial work, the same thing happened. We trial lawyers tend to be a gregarious bunch, and we'll gather in judges' chambers for a cup of coffee before the day's sessions begin, and there's a lot of backslapping, and, "Hey, how you doing, you know?" They slap you on, "Hey, Dick, how you doing?" And I never could do what I can do here. You know, I always want to turn around to one of those guys and go, "Oh, I'm afraid." That is not the correct answer. And even with the judges in those days, you know, I could, "Hey, Dick, how's it going? Oh, Your Honor, I threw up last night. I woke up this morning, somebody peed in my bed. How's it going with you, Your Honor? You can't carry on conversations like that. The third chapter tells us we admit to our innermost self. I had some difficulty with that. I did not have an innermost self. Beneath this phony comic veneer is the real comic veneer. I did admit to others that I was an alcoholic because it was great. I'd be in a bar, you know, "Dick, why do you drink so much?" "Oh, I'm an alcoholic." "Oh," and they left me alone. It was great. Because I came from an Irish culture where alcohol was a complete defense. It was not in mitigation. It was an absolute defense. "Why did that man say that to that woman?" "Oh, the man was drinking." Oh, okay. Absolute defense. Absolute defense. But I got through that first step and I was able to admit that I was powerless and that my life had become unmanageable. And that began the journey for me. It was battered and scarred, and the auctioneer hardly thought it worthwhile to spend much time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. "What am I bid for this fiddle?" he said. "Who'll start the bidding for me?" $1, then. "Who'll make it two?" $2. "Who'll make it three?" $3 once, $3 twice, and going, but no. From the back of the room, an older man stepped forward and picked up the bow, and wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening its loosened string, he played a melody pure and rich as caroling angels sing. The music finished, and the auctioneer, in a voice that was hushed and low, said, "What am I bid for this fine violin?" And he held it up with a bow. $1,000. "Who'll make it two?" $2,000. "Who'll make it three?" $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, and going, and gone," said he. The crowd stood and cheered, but some of them said, "We just don't understand. What changed its worth?" Quick came the reply, "The touch of the master's hand." It was after the first step that I began to get some glimpse of what was in store for me in this program. Admitting my powerlessness was the beginning of it. Looking for a power became the next part. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. The second step, by the way, says we came to believe that. It doesn't say we came to believe in anything. That may come later. But I came to believe that, and I could believe that just from observing things around me. These steps that we talk about here, and the second step, the sanity they speak of, is a sanity of behavior. It has very little to do with what you're thinking. All of these steps, as written here, are nothing more than a report of actions taken. They are not a report of thoughts reviewed. They are not a report of feelings explored. They are a report of actions taken. And the action in the sanity step for me is learning to behave sane. I had a client in Georgia Regional Hospital. He was committed there for being insane, a misunderstanding. And he told me, he said, "I'm not here because I'm insane. I'm here because I acted insane. And when they let me go, it's not going to be because I've become sane. It's because I've learned how to act sane." And that's the greatest part of this program. You can think any damn thing you want, as long as you do what you're supposed to do. That third step made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. I go to meetings a lot and I hear people talking about, "Well, I turned it over and then I took it back. And then I turned it over and then I took it back again. And then I turned it over and I took it back." Oh, the operative phrase is not turnover. The operative word is decision. Made a decision. A pilot friend of mine tells me that on the trip from Atlanta to San Francisco, the plane is on course only about 2% of the time. The rest of the time, it's correcting. And that's what our decision is. We chart the course to take the rest of the steps, to follow the principles of the program. Does that mean we're going to remain perfectly on course? No. No more than that airplane is on course going to San Francisco all the time. if we stay on course 2% of the time, but know what the course is and spend the other 98% of the time trying to stay on it, we're doing what we're supposed to do. So don't turn it over and don't take it back. Just decide. This is the first and second glimpse. We notice we have atheists, people who purport to be atheists coming in here. I always felt sorry for atheists because they have nothing to holler out in the middle of sex. But I like how we get, how we suck in the atheists here, you know, that the second step is just a power greater than my, yeah, just the power, it doesn't say, just power, power greater than, well, all right. Well, a third step, turn a life, well, the will over to God, isn't it? No, it says that you understand him, and you understand him not to be, right? No problem. We're going to go through the fourth step. Dig up all that junk and trash from his life and carry it around for a while. By this time, he's been in a program about a year, and he's got his job back and his family back, and things are going better. And we get to the fifth step where we call God by his maiden name. Admit it to God. Ha, 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 gotcha, sucker. God, it was God. So we get him. One thing I know, I came in, as I say, straight into the program without the advantage or disadvantage of a treatment center. Physicians are helpful here. One of our founders was a physician. But they have no power to treat this disease. There is no human power. We come in here to find a power other than human. So they look for things that can be treated. They've come up with things like, you know, dual diagnosis. I remember when I first got here, every alcoholic that came into this program was hypoglycemic. And there's always a secondary disease du jour making its way around. Later on, they became bipolar. That was a big one. But it's just an effort by people who want to treat to find something they can treat. They can't treat the alcoholism, so they have a dual diagnosis. But I'm just not having come through the treatment center process. Maybe I don't appreciate that as much, but I've had people come in here and identify themselves as, you know, cross-addicted, which I guess, you know, just start off with a little cross and you make your way to a big crucifix, which is still better. It's better than being dual-addicted because, you know, if you're addicted to duels, you got a 50-50 shot, you know. One identify himself as poly-addicted. I thought that meant he's doing strange things with parrots, but that wasn't it. That third step taught me that, you know, a life run on self-will is hardly worth living. And it was difficult for me because the first part of my life was run largely on self-will. My dad was a steel worker. Children from families like that did not go to college, did not go to law school. I struggled and got scholarships to college and law school. And I always attributed it to self-will. And it got me to a point, but it, all it did was in achieving things. It was a self-will that was not helpful in living. And again, I was always so damn smart. In fact, I was sober about 3 weeks. And I had read through the big book and made some notes in the margin because I had some ideas for the next edition. My sponsor came, saw what I had done to the book. I may be the only pigeon in the history of AA whose sponsor took away his big book. Give me that damn thing. You got a meeting to listen for a while. I'll let you know when you're ready to write. I was so smart. I guess it was only about 7 or 8 years ago when I got an appreciation for the kinds of things I was smart at. My daughter came home with a sample SAT exam she was sitting for, and one of the questions read, "Sledgehammer is to X-ray as puberty is to A, Montana, B, tugboat, C, cheese bread." The really disturbing part of this is that I knew the answers to those questions better than 99.56% of the people in this country. It was a major shock to me to find out that I could not make a living knowing those things. That fourth step, my sponsor told me, he said, I was wallowing around in the first three steps in the fellowship, and he told me I had a lot of anger and resentment, and I had to take a fourth step. And I didn't think I had any anger and resentment. In fact, it kind of pissed me off when he told me that. So I took that first searchless and fearful moral inventory. Now, my moral inventory was one dictated by my sponsor in the big book. You will find people coming out of treatment centers to their first meeting when they got this 3,000-page tome they brought. It's their autobiography. Can you think of a sillier thing to do than to give an assignment to a certified egomaniac to write his autobiography? The first 2,900 pages are contained all the things that were wrong with his parents and how they were incapable of love. 50 pages on how nobody liked him in the fourth grade. It says an inventory, and that inventory is nothing more than what's on the shelf now. And I had to sit down and do that because I had nothing behind me but the Catholic practice of confession. And I guess it was helpful, but the inventory was as thorough as it's ever gotten with me. And I've made a point of taking him periodically, a periodic fourth step, so it's been helpful to me. I'm going to take a drink. The fifth step, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being. I admitted to God and myself. I could not find another human being, so I used my sponsor. It is at the fifth step that you begin to get a true sense of belonging to the program, because you can't go around, you know, keeping deep, dark secrets from somebody with whom you've taken your fifth step. You know, you already told them about the booze, the drugs, the women, the small farm animals. And you take your fifth step anyway. Usually it's best to just take your fourth step. That's what I did. And brought it to him. I have my practice involves computer contract litigation. One of my clients up in Raleigh, I was up speaking with the personnel who belong there and work there. And I went to a meeting that night, and one of the people at my business meeting in the daytime was at the evening meeting. And he saw me the next day. He's my sponsor's in Europe, and he's going to be there for a few more weeks. Can you listen to my fifth step? I said, sure. I said, where is it? He's come out of my office. So I get into his office, he hits a couple of buttons on his computer, and up comes his fourth step on the screen. He had cross-indexed it. Want to see how many times I've been resentful? It was at this time that I remembered that his computer was part of a local area network. And I told him he may already have taken his fifth step. One of the things I was there to litigate was computer security. But we've gotten beyond that now. You can take your fifth step by email on the internet. You write www.guesswhat.com. The push into a sixth step came entirely ready. Have God remove all the defects of character. I had to read that a couple of times. A lot of people want to read the word willing into that. It doesn't say willing, it says ready. And the big book takes maybe two or three sentences with the sixth step. It tells you to review what you've done before, make sure you've done it right, and go ahead. There is very little work to be done on the sixth step itself. Are you ready? We like it to be willing, because willing is an exercise of feeling and intellect. But ready is, have you taken the action necessary to do the next thing? We in law have an expression, ready, willing, and able. And excuse me if I read the big book like a lawyer, but I take the words for what they say. It's new. And those first five steps, intellectual process, but it's not. A couple of weeks ago, it came home to me. I was in an assembly in Macon. I'm a DCM from my home group, my home area. And one of the GSRs who was at Macon with me, we had a meeting at Sunday at 9 o'clock in the morning. He called me at 6, a little obsessive. He woke me up in my motel room, and I got up at 6 o'clock. I was willing to go to the state assembly meeting, but I was not yet ready because I hadn't taken the actions that were necessary to get there. So that sixth step is ready. Just worry about the ready. If you've taken a third step, don't worry too much about your own will anymore. Seventh was humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. The interesting part about the seventh step for me was it doesn't say humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, and he did. Doesn't say that. I still have every defect I came here with. The only difference is now they don't run my life. Like my feelings used to run everything. And now I've come to treat my feelings like flying an air cargo freight full of monkeys. I have to take care of them. I've got to feed them. I've got to give them exercise once in a while. And I go back in their cargo hold and I take care of them. But I don't let them into the cockpit. You know, keep them back there. And my defects aren't as severe. They're still there. They just don't interfere with my life the way they used to. It used to be you came up to me and told me you didn't like my tie. That gave me the right to burn down your house with your wife and kids in it. You know? I've just diminished my defects to the point where they can be lived with. At eighth step, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. My sponsor told me if I got past my immediate family and had more people on my list than I could count on two hands, I was probably bragging. Because we like to think we have an impact on people that we don't have. I had people on there whom I had thought badly of. It says harmed. Look at the harm you've done. Some people also tell you, don't forget to put yourself on the top of the list. More certified egomania coming to the fore. And nine steps has made direct amends. Made direct amends. Whenever possible. My sponsor took me aside once. I was ready to run around and apologize to everybody. It doesn't say apologize. It says amend. You're a lawyer. What does amend mean? As it means to change. Right. More action, fewer words. It was up to me to become a father to my children, become a partner to my partners, become a lawyer to my clients for the first time in a long time. Amends. Make the changes necessary. That tenth step says continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Tenth step says personal inventory, as opposed to moral inventory talked about in the fourth step. I suspect that's because by the time we get to the tenth step, we've developed personal standards by which to measure ourselves. At the fourth step, I had none. I had to use other people's. The Ten Commandments. The seven cardinal sins. I was suspended from school once because I asked the nun how the cardinal sins got their name. I also tried to avoid the consequences of the 10th step by reading it as, if I was wrong, promptly admitted it. It didn't say if, it says when. Oh, well. The 11th step told me that thought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will and the power to carry it out. This is the longest and the most powerful of the steps. It assumes that there's been some prior contact that you're going to improve on. And it doesn't say what I originally thought it said. It said, I thought I was going to do this 11th step and then I would know God's will. No. Excuse my lawyering again. It says, get a knowledge of His will. That's the difference between knowing somebody and knowing of somebody. I'm not going to get to know His will. I may get a knowledge of His will for me. I frequently think I know it for you, too, and I'd be happy to share that with you if you care to ask. But that's not what the 11th step tells me. I got a knowledge of His will for me. And recently, with difficulties in my life, there's a portion of that 12 and 12 that's been helpful. It says, in seasons of grief and suffering, when the hand of God seemed heavy or even unjust, new lessons in life were learned and new resources of courage were uncovered. And what this requires of me, and more than any other virtue, I suspect, is the patience to wait. The patience to wait for that knowledge, to see when it comes. That 12th step tells us, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. I misread that one too. I thought it said having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. It's not a result, it's the result. And I'm glad I misunderstood it. Because if I had understood it properly when I first got here, and I asked my sponsor, well, what'll happen if I don't drink and I go to these meetings and I practice all these steps and I do my 90 and 90, what's going to happen? You'll have a spiritual awakening. That would have thrilled the hell out of you, wouldn't it? I told him early on, I don't need a spiritual awakening. I need money. He never understood. Never understood. Bill tried to carry this. It now says awakening. It used to say experience. Bill had a heavy hand in this, and the experience he wrote about was very close to his own, with the wind and the light in the hospital. Except that experience is so personal, you have very little to share with anyone. Bill tried to share it. You're walking around the bars in New York at 8 o'clock in the morning, looking for, you know, social drinkers who happen to be in the bars at 8 o'clock in the morning, and give them the message about the light and the wind. And, oh. Of course, the people who carried these messages to, they were not only alcoholics, they were New York City alcoholics. So they were, of course, unusually appreciative of the spiritual message he was trying to bring them. In fact, several of them had several friendly suggestions as to what he might do with his spiritual experience. But the awakening we're talking about here is a gradual, and it's the one part of our steps that have changed since the original publication. The early meetings, when I got going, people would read that the first edition that contained the story about a spiritual experience of the 12th step. And they started getting letters from Kansas. You know, we're meeting here in the church, the three of us. We've been doing this for 6 months now, and we haven't seen the wind or the light. You know, what are we doing wrong? Please advise. We're also asked to carry the message here. Now, I've heard you do this, I guess, traditionally through what we call 12-step work. I've had people tell me they get 12-step calls at 1 and 2 in the morning. I used to get 12-step calls at my house when there were four children
young children around, my calls used to come at supper time. And supper time in a house with four kids can be hell. And I'd try to get a quiet moment to talk to this guy. And if he sounded like he was all right, I'd try to meet him around 7 o'clock so that if he was good there, I could take him to an 8 o'clock meeting somewhere. And I'd be on the way out, and the wife would say, you know, well, if you're going to go out for the evening, could you help get the kids ready for bed? I said, sure. Did you ever try and convince a 2- and a 4-year-old that just because they're putting their pajamas on now doesn't mean they have to go to bed right now? Come on, get your pajamas on. It's not bedtime. Don't put your pajamas on now. You go to bed later. Come on, my pajamas on. You make me go to bed now. No, I'm going to put your pajamas on now. Go to bed later. How are you going to make me go to bed? Too early to go to bed. God damn it, I'll put your pajamas on. And I'd be leaving the house, and the wife would say, you know, when are you be back? I said, soon as I get this son of a bitch some of my serenity. You know. But you carry what you can carry. My journey through this program in the 12 steps has not been all that unique. I've been through all the things everybody else has been through. When I got here, I had lost the family, the career, the income, and I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 2 years sober, my oldest son needed open heart surgery, and we found out he was a retarded child, and I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 3 and 5 years sober, a reunited family, we had 2 new children, and I shared the joy with my fellows, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 8 years sober, my younger son was diagnosed with cancer, and I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 13 years sober, he was declared cured of his cancer, and I shared the joy, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And here last January, in my 19th year of sobriety, my oldest son, Brendan, was called back by God. And I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. I'm happy for the chip the Bill W. Group gave me tonight, because it's one I can carry with me. My first chip that I received from my home group has been placed on the marker at Brendan's grave. This Brendan, my retarded son, was the one who God sent to get me sober. My firstborn child was a typical firstborn and self-sufficient. And I was able to deceive myself that she didn't need a father. But when Brendan came with all his disabilities, it became apparent right away that I could not stay drunk and be that boy's father. So Brendan got me sober. And Brendan, as much as any sponsor, taught me the lessons of life. His was such a simple and direct acknowledgement of the presence of God that nothing interfered with him. Last Christmas, we were out at a mall. My daughter was singing with a choir. You know how they go into the malls and they sing carols for a while. And I went there with Brendan to watch his sister sing. And I sat down, and there was still piped in music coming around from the mall. I don't think that's people singing here. Well, they turn off the goddamn music. And behind me was an amusement room with the doors open and the pinball machines and the electric games making noises. I guess people are singing. Close those damn doors. People are singing out here. And after pesking with the sound in the amusement room, Brendan turned to me and said, "Isn't the singing beautiful?" He was there for what he was there for. And so my 20-year chip for my home group went to Brendan, and this one from my Bill W. lunch group will stay with me. Hundreds of times in the scripture, in the Bible, we hear the phrase, "and it came to pass." Never do we hear the phrase, "and it came to stay." I was raised to believe that eternity is not an endless expanse of time, but it's a complete absence of time. And we, by living in the now, by living today, that endless expanse of time and the complete absence of time. The absence of time means it's a constant now. And when we live in the now, we live for today, we grab a little piece of eternity right here when we live for the now. Because we are preparing for that constant now and for our closeness to our higher power. And that higher power doesn't demand a lot of us. He demands only honesty. He doesn't demand truth. Truth is his domain. He gives us bits and pieces of truth, but all we're responsible for is honesty. And the one little truth that I have to maintain is the central operative truth of my life, is the truth with which I began my remarks to you this evening. And that truth is that my name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.